134 days has passed since the start of the U.S.-Israeli genocide in Gaza. The Palestinian death toll is nearing 29,000, mostly women and children. Hamas reiterates that it will not settle for anything less than a full cessation of Israeli aggression, blaming Tel Aviv for the stalemate in talks on Gaza ceasefire. Also coming up, the head of the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees says that Israel is waging a concerted campaign to destroy UNRWA. Thanks for joining us. The Palestinian Red Crescent Society warns that Israeli attacks on health facilities and staff in Gaza are posing a significant threat to the lives of those in need of medical care. The warning comes as Israeli forces persist on targeting Khan Yunis, a southern city in Gaza. The Al-Amal Hospital is also under a complete siege, with Israeli armored vehicles blocking its entrances. The regime forces have declared a curfew around the hospital and terrorized the people taking shelter there to vacate the complex. Meanwhile, Nasser Hospital, the largest medical facility in Khan Yunis, also remained under siege. Four patients died on Friday due to the lack of oxygen, as shelling caused the power outage there. This is the 134th day since Israel launched its genocidal war in Gaza. Over 28,800 Palestinians have been killed, and according to the UN, nearly 2 million people displaced since then.
As Israel continues to press ahead with its genocidal war in Gaza, more painful details emerge regarding the long-term consequences Palestinians face. Especially children, psychological traumas are among the long list of issues civilians in the coastal strip grapple with.
This war is the most brutal war we have ever lived. It deeply impacted the entire Gaza population, particularly the children. They become very scared and fearful when they hear any explosion or airstrike. We are experiencing unprecedented psychological traumas. The absence of international organizations has made it difficult to deal with the needs of Gazans.
As a matter of fact, what Palestinian children have been witnessing in the last 4 months is unprecedented. This hadn't happened over the recent wars against Palestinians. Unbelievably, 70% of Gaza's housing units have been partially or completely destroyed. Vast majority of houses were pummeled as they were inhabited by civilians.
We've been in the tent in Rafah for 2 months. My children became sick and tired. Then we decided to flee to an UNRWA school in Deir al-Balah. Once we arrived there, the Israeli warplane targeted the mosque that was nearby. We got severely injured. My little son was severely affected. His life was completely changed. He can't eat or sleep well. We hope this ends soon.
Children experience the same issues in evacuation centers elsewhere in the devastated strip. They are repeatedly displaced and experience catastrophic conditions. The only news they hear is news of massacres and killings. All these details will be ingrained deeply in their souls, and surely they will carry them for life.
Before this war started, we used to live normally. We had our life. We used to go to school, play with our friends, and sleep well in our homes. After this war began, we lost everything. We hear only the sound of the missiles and airstrikes. We don't sleep or eat well. We know nothing about the rest of our families, why this happens to us.
It's quite difficult for anyone outside Gaza to believe that many Palestinian children have not yet recovered from a trauma they suffered in 2014 during Israeli aggression on Gaza. Apparently, the Palestinian children will take years and years to heal from the severe trauma and psychological problems they sustained before the eyes of the ignorant international community. Abu Musabbih, the central area of Gaza Strip.
The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has blamed the Israeli regime for a lack of progress in talks on the potential Gaza ceasefire. In a statement, the Hamas political bureau chief said the movement will not settle for anything less than a full cessation of Israeli aggression, the withdrawal of forces from Gaza, and the lifting of the blockade on the territory. Ismail Haniyeh said Israel must also release Palestinians serving long sentences in any upcoming prisoner swap deal. Hania made the remarks just days after U.S. and Israeli spy chiefs, as well as Qatari and Egyptian officials, met in Cairo to discuss the framework of a Gaza ceasefire proposal. The talks reportedly ended inconclusively. The framework, which was hammered out in Paris last month, suggested three-phase truce lasting 45 days each that could see the resolution of several issues. Political commentator Julia Kassam says that Israel has not achieved any of its objectives in the Gaza Strip and is trying to make the territory uninhabitable.
So this is time and time and again, Israel has, every time it has lost in a region, moved down to the next hospital to claim it's gaining ground around the region. And then, of course, in the absence of any tangible military victory, since all it's accrued is losses upon losses, it decides to pull its guns on innocents in hospitals. Instead of fighting who it's supposed to be fighting, who it's the Palestinian resistance, which is victoriously beating it, it's basically killed innocents in hospitals. It besieged them. It removes all of the electricity and deprives them of medical equipment and facilities. It bombs them in their vicinities, and it even at the Al-Nasser hospital in early November, it left five babies at the ICU, five children to die, and of course it tries to save face and execute the Zionist regime's next plan of just making Gaza uninhabitable and terrorizing people into forcing them from the enclave into the Sinai is the next objective when there is a complete absence of any real military goals achieved. As they've lost across Gaza, they've been forced to withdraw from regions of the north up to Khan Yunis, as I mentioned. And right now, in Gaza, their last-ditch chance, and this seems to be definitely the plan from the beginning, to corner every civilian in Rafah to either force them to move into the Sinai or to die.
Head of the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees, Philippe Lazzarini, says that Israel is waging a concerted campaign aimed at dismantling UNRWA. Lazzarini said the regime believes that if the UN agency is abolished, the status of the Palestinian refugees will be resolved once and for all, and with it, the right of return. He said this has been a long-term political goal of Tel Aviv. He cited various Israeli actions as evidence, including revoking UNRWA's VAT exemptions, restricting food deliveries through Ashdod Port, and targeting over 150 UNRWA facilities since October 7. Israel has called for Lazzarini to step down, following claims that a Hamas tunnel had been discovered under its evacuated Gaza City headquarters. Lazzarini said the tunnel was 20 below ground and UNRWA, as a humanitarian organization, did not have the capabilities to examine what was underground in Gaza. Thousands of Yemenis have taken to the streets of Sana'a and other cities to reaffirm their full support for the Palestinian people and the resistance front. Abdel Latif al-Washali has more from Sana'a.
Yemenis from all walks of life gathered in the capital Sana'a and other cities to reaffirm their unwavering support for their Palestinian brothers and the resistance forces. People from as far away as Saudi Arabia's Najran province joined the gathering.
We, the tribes and nobles of Najran, came here in response to the call by Abdul Malik al-Houthi to support the people of Gaza. We declare from Sana'a that we are with Ansarullah in standing against the Zionists and the Americans who are committing genocide in Gaza. All Arabs and Muslims must stand by Gaza as it is a religious, national and humanitarian duty.
The position of the Yemeni people is consistent with its leadership. They are all in one accord with Palestine and with the axis of resistance. It is necessary to act with one's heart and soul. People have come out today to express their position and steadfastness until Palestine is liberated.
The protesters condemned the Israeli aggression against Rafah on the border of Egypt and urged their armed forces to intensify naval operations in response to the regime's war crimes in Rafah. They expressed willingness to join the Yemeni armed forces and fight against those who commit horrible crimes against innocent civilians in Gaza.
All Yemenis, young and old, men and women, learn to use all types of weapons, from pistols to automatic rifles, anti-aircraft guns and missiles. Everyone is preparing for the decisive battle with the Zionists. When we declare that we are ready, it is not to brag in the media, but rather we are truly prepared to confront America, Israel and those with them.
Earlier, the spokesman for the Yemeni army stated that the forces had successfully targeted a British ship in the Gulf of Aden using naval missiles. He also pledged to continue preventing Israeli-linked vessels from sailing through the Bab el-Mandeb Strait until the Israeli genocide stops.
People here believe that it is time for Muslims around the world to unite against the Israeli enemy and its backers. They call on the people across the Arab world to take to the streets and initiate concrete actions against the Israeli atrocities in Gaza.
Iran has unveiled two domestically manufactured air defense systems as part of a national drive to boost the country's defense. The Ministry of Defense unveiled the Arman anti-ballistic missile system as well as a low-altitude air defense system called Azarash. Arman, a tactical missile interception system, is capable of firing several missiles simultaneously within a range of 75 to 120 kilometers. Experts say the range can be increased up to 150 kilometers. The system is designed to operate at intermediate and high altitudes and is made up of a transporter, launcher, and radar. Other mobile missile launchers can be attached to the Arman system as well. Iran has unveiled and inducted to the armed forces several indigenously made defense systems, including missile and drones, in recent months. The leader of the Hezbollah resistance movement has pledged retaliation for Israel's killing of civilians in South Lebanon, yet analysts believe that even such retaliation will be precisely calculated. Our correspondent in Beirut, Mariam Saleh, has more.
On the martyrdom anniversary of three prominent leaders, Hezbollah Secretary General vowed that the resistance will retaliate for the Israeli strikes that killed civilians in South Lebanon, considering them deliberate massacres.
I tell friend and foe, the enemy will pay in blood for the bloodshed of our women and children in the last few days in Nabatea and Sawana and other towns of South Lebanon.
Analysts believe Nasrallah's words are very significant, but so is his deliberate silence on several issues.
This is the general approach with Sayyid Hassan always takes, trying to keep the enemy always in a state of psychological fear, not expecting or not being able to anticipate how the retaliation might come.
Hezbollah declared it launched a first retaliation for the massacres by launching Katyusha rockets against targets in Kiryat Shmona. But the leader of the resistance responded to the Israeli war minister Yoav Gallant's threats against Lebanon, saying the rocket capabilities of the Lebanese resistance goes beyond that.
Perhaps Gallant has forgotten that the resistance possesses a massive and precise missile power that enables it to strike Kiryat Shmona and all the way to Eilat.
He also underlined that the resistance front in the region as a whole has been able to enforce a balance of power, which bars the Israelis and the United States from achieving their goals.
He said that the Yemenis, in the action they took, did not resort to focusing on the Americans in the military operations, but rather continue to focus on Israel. And he said that that must remain the strategy. So I think that that's a very important. Sayyid Hassan continues to set realistic goals and to focus on weakening the Israeli side and not to go into some rash kind of action which could lead to strategically backfiring against the axis of resistance.
Hezbollah supporters commemorate yearly the martyrdom of Hezbollah's late Secretary General Sayyid Abbas Mousawi, who was assassinated in an Israeli strike on the martyrdom anniversary of Sheikh Raghib Harb, a leader of the grassroots movement. Hezbollah is also commemorating the martyrdom of its top military commander, Haimad Mughniyeh. The martyrdom of each of Hezbollah's leaders remembered today signaled a new stage in the resistance movement's development. Now, any miscalculation by the Israeli regime could be a turning point in Hezbollah's use of its covert capabilities. Mariam Saleh, Beirut.
South Koreans, Palestinians, and supporters of Palestine have once again hit the streets of Seoul. The protest comes as Israel intensifies its bombardments on the southern Gaza city of Rafah and what protesters here call war crimes and genocide. They demand an end to Israeli attacks, and a ceasefire, as well as an end to the blanket support for Israel by the U.S. and its allies. Frank Smith has more from Seoul.
Palestinians and their supporters took their message to the streets of the South Korean capital, Seoul, again, as Israel's onslaught on Gaza continues unabated. Palestinians in Seoul reminded the participants of the accounts of the Israeli army's indiscriminate killing of innocents in the besieged territory.
Do you know the story of Hin, the Palestinian girl who lost her life recently? She was surrounded by Israeli tanks for 3 hours before being shot dead by Israeli soldiers.
Global support for Palestinians is growing.
Never give up. Because if we do, who will stand next to the children who are dying in Gaza right now?
Israel's attacks on Rafah, a city with 1.5 million Palestinian refugees, have galvanized people around the world with demands for access to humanitarian aid and the establishment of a ceasefire. This demonstration is taking place within sight of the U.S. Embassy for a reason. Supporters of Palestine, like those here today, argue that the U.S. enables Tel Aviv's genocide in the Gaza Strip with its ongoing support of Israel, unconditional military and economic support. They argue that backing needs to stop. Critics of U.S. policy say a full-scale invasion of Rafah would further incite anti-American sentiment worldwide.
The United States continues its enormous support for Israel. They are talking about peace with words, but it's a lie and hypocrisy, as even now, they provide huge amounts of aid and weapons for Israel.
Demonstrators then march through the center of the capital to get their message to people on this global day of action in support of Palestinians, passing by a focal point of their frustration, the American Embassy. Frank Smith, Seoul.
And that does it for World News. Thanks for tuning in.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The Limelight. In Britain, Liberal Democrats say last month an average of 5,735 people a day faced waits of 12 hours or more to be seen in accidents and emergency departments in hospitals. We take a look at the British media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. More than 1.5 million patients in England had to wait 12 hours or longer in accidents and emergency departments in the past year, according to figures that MPs say lay bare the impact of the government's neglect of the National Health Service. Last month, 177,805 patients faced waits of 12 hours or more to be seen in emergency departments, an average of 5,735 a day. It means 1 in 10 patients, or 12.4% of patients, arriving at accidents and emergency departments waited 12 hours before being admitted, transferred, or discharged. In total, between February of 2023 and January of 2024, 1,540,945 patients experienced long waits, according to analysis of official data by the Liberal Democrats. Every day, thousands of patients are being left scared and in pain in overcrowded accidents and emergency departments, waiting for 12 hours or more to receive the care that they need. According to Daisy Cooper, the Liberal Democrats' health spokesperson, Daisy Cooper added, "These devastating delays lay bare the stark impact of this government's neglect of the National Health Service." January was the worst month in the past year as winter pressures struck. In some hospitals, 1 in 4 patients faced delays of 12 hours or more. One 88-year-old woman was left waiting 16 hours, according to the Liberal Democrats. The analysis showed the actual amount of time patients spent in accidents and emergency departments after arriving before being admitted to hospital, transferred, or discharged. The figures are separate from last week's published trolley wait figures, which only measure the time taken after a decision to admit a patient has been made. The number of people waiting more than 12 hours in accidents and emergency departments from a decision to admit them to actually being admitted to hospitals soared to 54,308 in January, up sharply from 44,045 in December. This was the second highest figure on record, just below 54,573 in December of 2022. The number of people who waited at least 4 hours from the decision to admission also grew from 148,282 in December to 158,721 last month. Again, the second highest figure on record. Long waits at accidents and emergency departments have been linked to serious patient harm. The Royal College of Emergency Medicine has previously highlighted data showing that once people wait more than about 6 hours and need to be admitted into hospital, their risk of dying starts to increase. Daisy Cooper said, "Waits of 12 hours or more can have catastrophic consequences for people's health, particularly the elderly and vulnerable people. No one should have to wait this long for care, yet in some areas, this unacceptably long delays have become almost the norm. It's time Conservative ministers started taking this National Health Service crisis seriously instead of ignoring all the warning signs while patients are suffering." The Department of Health and Social Care said accidents and emergency performance was improving despite winter pressures and the highest number of January accidents and emergency attendances on record. "We're determined to continue improving patient care, having already delivered on our promise to create 5,000 extra permanent hospital beds and 10,000 hospital at home beds, freeing up capacity and cutting waiting times," according to a spokesperson. British newspaper The Nottingham Post has also covered this story. More than 1,000 people were stuck waiting for over 12 hours in accidents and emergency departments in Nottinghamshire last month. The latest data from the National Health Service has shown a dramatic increase in patients experiencing a 12-hour wait to be admitted to accidents and emergency departments in January over the last 8 years. A total of 900 patients at Nottingham University Hospital's NHS Trust and 224 patients at Sherwood Forest Hospital's NHS Foundation Trust had a 12-hour wait to be admitted to accidents and emergency in January, according to the latest data from the National Health Service. That's up from 855 last January at Nottingham University Hospitals and 289 at Sherwood Forest Hospitals. In January of 2022, there were 514 and 40 at the two respective hospitals who had to wait over 12 hours to be admitted. Back in January of 2019, there were none at either NHS Trust, nor in January of 2018, while in 2017 there were just two patients at Nottingham University Hospitals. Nationally, a total of 54,308 patients had a 12-hour wait to be admitted to accidents and emergency this January. This is the second highest number on record, behind only December of 2022, when 54,573 people had to wait over 12 hours. The Liberal Democrat website has also covered this story and tells us more. A staggering 1.5 million patients in England waited 12 hours or more after arriving at accidents and emergency departments over the past year, new analysis by the Liberal Democrats has revealed. The figures reveal the true scale of the accidents and emergency delays over a 12-month period for the first time. Shockingly, at some NHS trusts, over 1 in 4 patients are facing delays of 12 hours or more after arriving at accidents and emergency departments. The Liberal Democrats said it showed that 12-hour delays had become almost the norm in some areas of England. The previously hidden data from NHS England shows the actual amount of time patients spent in accidents and emergency after arriving before being admitted to hospital, transferred or discharged. These figures are separate from the regularly published trolley wait figures, which only measure the time taken after a decision to admit a patient has been made. The latest figures show that in total, 1,540,945 patients faced waits of 12 hours or more after arriving at accidents and emergency between February of 2023, when the new data was first published, to January of 2024. This equates to almost 1 in 10 or 9.6% of patients during that period, 5 times higher than the National Health Service requirement that no more than 2% of patients should wait 12 hours or more. Shockingly, it means an average of over 4,200 patients waited over 12 hours at accidents and emergency departments every day over the past year. January saw the worst figures yet as winter pressure stuck, with a record 177,805 or 1 in 8 patients, that is 12.4%, facing accidents and emergency waits of over 12 hours. At Blackpool Teaching Hospitals, over 1 in 4 patients in January faced accidents and emergency delays of 12 hours or more, the worst in the country. This was followed by Shrewsbury and Telford Hospital with 25.4%. Research from the Royal College of Emergency Medicine has previously estimated that for every 82 admitted patients whose transfer to a hospital bed is delayed beyond 6 to 8 hours from arrival, there is one extra death. Liberal Democrat health spokesperson Daisy Cooper MP said, "These devastating delays lay bare the stark impact of this government's neglect of the National Health Service. Every day, thousands of patients are being left scared and in pain in overcrowded accidents and emergency departments waiting for 12 hours or more to receive the care that they need. Waits of 12 hours or more can have catastrophic consequences for people's health, particularly the elderly and the vulnerable. No one should have to wait this long for care, yet in some areas these unacceptably long delays have become almost the norm."
first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuha alladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis-sabri was-salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
The audience of IRB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Now it's time to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Ja'far Ja'far.
I begin in the name of Allah, the most kind, the most merciful. It's due to His kindness and mercy that He gives us these opportunities where we gather in remembrance and glorification of Him, Tabaraka wa Ta'ala. The lesson that I want to take for today from the life of our third Imam is how to gain or attain happiness. The happiness that God wants, that God says, this is where you will find happiness. The first quality that the Imam alayhi salam possessed is the desire for success in the hereafter above anything else. Above anything else. If you read Surah Al-Haqqah, verses 19 through 30, it's an amazing description God gives us. He says, and I'll just read the first half. He says, فَأَمَّا مَنْ أُوتِيَ كِتَابَهُ بِيَمِينِهِ. He says, then as for those people who are given their books on their right side, on their right hand, فَيَقُولُ هَا أُمَكْرُوا كِتَابِيَ. Yeah? They will say, here, read my book. Yeah? Imagine the confidence you gotta have to tell God, read my book. Yeah? Why? إِنِّي ذَنَنْتُ أَنِّي مُلَاقٍ حِسَابِيَ. He says, I was sure that you would take account of this. I prepared for it, Ya Allah, read my book. Yeah? That is preparation. That is preparation. Yeah? To be prepared means you're ready to tell God, read my book. Yeah? I've been waiting for this day, Ya Allah. Yeah? That is a whole nother level, my brothers and sisters, right? That means I would avoid those things which would go on that book that would be detrimental to me. But I would only add to that book that which is going to bring me success in the hereafter. And whatever happens in this world, I will just flick it off my shoulder and keep planning for the hereafter. That's the expectation. Yeah? So that's number one. The second lesson, yeah, that we learn from our third Imam alayhi salam that brings happiness is when we help others find happiness. Yeah? This is important. Yeah? This is important. Our responsibility in this world, yeah, is to make the lives of others better. Yeah? That's our goal. And the moment we can bring happiness to others in their lives, the return is God says, I will give you happiness. Yeah? Our sixth Imam has this very beautiful hadith where he says, La yara ahadukum إِذَا أَدْخَلَ عَلَىٰ مُؤْمِنْ سُرُورًا. That one of you should not lose sight of the fact that when you bring happiness to a believer, أَنَّهُ عَلَيْهِ أَدْخَلَهُ فَقَدْ. That you brought happiness to that believer alone. Yeah? He says that when you bring happiness to a believer, don't consider or don't think that you have brought happiness just to that person. Bal, wallahi alayna, bal, by God, I swear, he says, wallahi ala Allah wa ala Rasulillah. Yeah? That you brought happiness not only to that person, you brought happiness to God and to the Prophet. Yeah? Subhanallah. Yeah? That we try just to make other people happy. Yeah? This is something there are so many examples of, yeah, that we see. And the fact is, you know, like I said, when we look at what happens in this world, it has to be suffocating. It has to be. Yeah? And this is one of the things we have to develop. But in that suffocation, one of the outcomes that comes from that is helplessness. Yeah? Where I feel I'm helpless. There's nothing I can do. Right? Allah does not expect us to change the world. Allah expects us to change the life of one person at a time. Yeah? One person at a time. Today I can make someone happy. Do it. Don't waste that opportunity. Do it. Yeah? Tomorrow God will send somebody else that I can make happy. And then the day after, God will send somebody else. Why? Because God saw I made someone happy. Yeah? And it's loved by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And when you look at the life of our third imam, you find that he would never lose the opportunity to make someone else happy. Yeah? There's a beautiful hadith, you know, or a beautiful story that is narrated by Jabir ibn Abdullah al-Ansari. He says, one day I was walking to see our third imam. And I met this very poor man. Yeah? And I said, and he asked me, and he said, where are you going? And Jabir says, I'm going to see Aba Abdullah. And so he says that I wish I could go see him. Yeah? He's like, I'm suffering, I'm going through extreme difficulty. So the imam says, come. Yeah, Jabir says, come, let's go see. Let's go see the imam together. And the man said, I can't go see the imam. Yeah, he says, look at my condition. Yeah, he says, I am in torn clothing. Yeah, I am dirty. I don't have shoes. He's like, how can I go into the presence of the imam like this? Yeah, but Jabir says, come on, let's go. And so when they go into the presence of the imam alayhi salam, the imam looks at this man and he says, come here. Yeah, and the man hesitates, yeah? Because maybe he's nervous, whatever, he hesitates. And then the imam looks at him again and says, come here, the poor sit with the poor. Yeah, goosebumps. The poor sit with the poor. Yeah, the imam alayhi salam, just by that statement, even if he didn't give the man anything, brought happiness to the heart of the man. Yeah, without a doubt. Why? Because he treated somebody with akhlaq. Yeah, he treated someone with respect. Yeah, he treated someone who thought that he was not worthy. He made him feel beyond worthy. Yeah, beyond worthy. He says, come, sit with me. Yeah, and then Jabir says that before that man could even say anything, the imam gave him clothing and money, and the man was well off after that. Why? Because the imam made someone happy. My brothers and sisters, you want happiness? Make others happy. See, the problem that we have is that we think happiness lies in these material things and we never are satisfied. Never are satisfied. But when we can do something for others without wanting anything back from that person, that's what brings happiness. That last point is important, yeah? Because sometimes I may give you something in the back of my mind, I'll be like, "Hum awis ek dios." Yeah? I'll come one day and collect this. No, you give because it's the right thing to do. Right? Make someone happy. That's number two. So the first one, everything we do has to be with the intention of the hereafter. Number two, we make other people happy. The third lesson we learn from our Imam alayhi salam to bring happiness into our lives is to surround ourselves with spiritually and religiously healthy companions. Yeah? With the right friends. With the right companions, with the right circles. It's amazing that we've been talking about this in Jummah for the last 5 weeks. Yeah, the ashab, the right companions in our lives. But this, when you look at the life of the Imam alayhi salam, the people he had around him, yeah, were the absolute right companions. The absolute right companions. Yeah, the companions who had the same goal as the Imam. Yeah, the companions who had the same outlook as the Imam. And this is a godly outlook. Again, I can have many friends around me who could have things in common with me when it comes to this world. But that's not what we're talking about. We need friends who have the same outlook of the hereafter. Yeah, that we're planning this. And even if that friend is just one person, you and your wife, accept that. Yeah, that's the right person for you. Yeah, that's the right person who will take you there. And this is something that when we look at Karbala, we see it. Yeah, this is why that statement that we read today in Jum'ah, where the Imam alayhi salam says to them, by God, I have never seen or heard of better companions than this in my life. Yeah, never. And we said, there were these amazing companions of Haydar. The amazing companions of Rasulullah, but the companions who are with Aba Abdullah stand out from the rest. Stand out. Yeah? And this is something that we have to work on in our life.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar, Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
روحي كريم عظيم عليم حليم حكيم متين غفور شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صل عليه.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
According to the British Retail Consortium, shop thefts in England have more than doubled in the past 3 years, costing retailers some £953 million a year. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. UK shop workers are facing 1,300 incidents of violence and abuse a day and a battle to control brazen acts of shoplifting as pressure mounts on ministers to intervene to protect retail employees. According to the British Retail Consortium, the trade body which represents most major shops retailers in Britain, retailers saw the number of incidents of racial abuse, sexual harassment, physical assaults and threats with weapons rise 50% last year, while thefts more than doubled to 16.7 million incidents. The rise in retail crime has coincided with a period of rampant price inflation, with the cost of everyday goods from eggs to baby formula increasing over the past 2 years at a rate not seen since records began in the 1970s, leaving many families struggling to make ends meet. Some experts argue that efforts to cut labour costs by using technology such as self-checkouts have contributed to the problem, while retailers are blaming a rise in organised crime and scarce police resources. Helen Dickinson, the British Retail Consortium's chief executive, called for police to step up the number of arrests. Helen Dickinson said, despite retailers investing huge sums in crime prevention, violence and abuse against retail workers is climbing. Criminals are being given a free pass to steal goods and to abuse and assault retail colleagues. No one should have to go to work fearing for their safety. The number of thefts has quadrupled on a pre-pandemic levels. Violence and abuse, which fell after a spike during the lockdowns of 2020, have jumped back up and are now 3 times higher than before the pandemic. The latest figures come after almost 90 retail leaders, including the bosses of Tesco, Sainsbury's, Boots and WH Smith, wrote to the government in October, demanding action on rising retail crime, as they said violent criminals were emptying stores. The British newspaper The Financial Times has also covered this story and tells us more. Retailers want the British government to introduce a standalone offence of assaulting, threatening or abusing a retail worker, arguing that this would enable police to understand the scale of the issue and send a message that such crimes are being taken seriously. Under a similar law introduced in Scotland in 2021, retail crimes now carry tougher sentences and require police to record all incidents of retail crime and allow the allocation of more resources. Helen Dickinson, the British Retail Consortium's chief executive, said, "Why should our hard-working colleagues south of the border be offered less protection?" Katie Bourne, the Sussex Police and Crime Commissioner, who is the lead for business crime at the Association of Police and Crime Commissioners, said the levels of retail crime being reported were unprecedented, adding, "Every day retail staff are facing the consequences of shoplifting, brazen behaviour, and that's why I have supported the call for a specific offence of assault on a shop worker." She added, "Our courts need to work more efficiently and shoplifters need to be deterred from re-offending." The Co-op, which has more than 2,000 stores across the United Kingdom, said it was installing 200 secure till kiosks, locked cabinets for expensive goods, and artificial intelligence technology to monitor self-checkouts in its supermarkets after a 44% surge in retail crime last year. It has also doubled the amount it spends on security guards. Last year, the fashion and homeware retailer Nexus boss Simon Wolfson also said he had seen a rise in shoplifting, which had hit profit margins at Next. That came after John Lewis said it suffered a £12 million year-on-year increase in theft, with its chair Sharon White calling shoplifting an epidemic. Paul Gerard from the Co-op said the majority of thefts were by people stealing to sell on goods in large volumes and could be accompanied by threats of abuse. Gerard added, "People are being followed home from work. I know of one example where we had to move people for their own safety." He said violent theft happened in city centres and leafy market towns, with professional criminals moving on to other stores if extra security measures were put in place at a favoured target. Co-op stores in some areas were reporting more than 2 incidents a week, where criminals have jumped over till kiosks to steal cigarettes, lottery cards and cash. However, Paul Gerard said there had been green shoots in the past few months as a result of the government's Retail Crime Action Plan published in October, which includes a police commitment to prioritise attending reports of shoplifting involving violence against a shop worker or where security guards have detained an offender. The plan also involves the more controversial Project Pegasus, under which 10 of the country's biggest retailers, including Marks & Spencer, Boots and Primark, are handing CCTV images to police to be run through databases using facial recognition technology in an effort to identify prolific or potentially dangerous individuals. Paul Gerard said police attendance at incidents at Co-op stores had shot up to 60% from 20% in October, which was a real step forward. He said, "Until October, there was no risk in engaging in that type of activity, and now there is a real risk of being arrested and prosecuted." Recently, a coalition of Britain's largest retail associations, including the British Retail Consortium and the Association of Convenience Stores, sent a letter to every police and crime commissioner in England and Wales, decrying a level of shoplifting that they said was having an enormous financial impact on businesses. They said retailers are facing unprecedented levels of shop theft in their stores, with many now seeing organized looting of their businesses on a regular basis. Yet, the Association of Convenience Stores, which represents more than 30,000 local shops, told the Financial Times that shoplifting in its sector had risen to a level it had never seen before. It argued that the discrepancy between the experience of retailers and official statistics was because of a lack of crimes against business, only 16% by its estimation being reported. You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,880 kHz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Iranian news. Iranian culture. Iranian voice. www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
On the occasion of the 40th anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution, February 11th, 2019, you should know that if ignorance of the revolution's mottos and negligence of the revolutionary movement had not occurred in some periods during the 40-year history of the revolution, which unfortunately existed and were extremely detrimental, the revolution's accomplishments would have gone far beyond what we witness today, and the country would have been far ahead on the path towards the great ideals and many of the current problems would not have existed today. Today, just like the first days after the revolution, sovereign Iran faces challenges from the imperialist, arrogant powers. Yet, there is a meaningful difference.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
If the challenges posed by the United States those days involved ending the intrusion by foreign agents or closing down the embassy of the Zionist regime in Tehran or exposing the spy den, the former U.S. embassy in Tehran, today the challenges concern Iran's strong presence near the borders of the Zionist regime, putting an end to the United States' unlawful infiltration in the West Asia, the Islamic Republic's support of the Palestinian people's resistance at the heart of the occupied territories, as well as defending the high-flying flag of Hezbollah and the resistance throughout this region. If, then, the West's concern was to prevent Iran from buying basic weaponry, today their concern is to prevent the transfer of advanced Iranian weapons to the resistance forces. If on those days the United States presumed that the Islamic government and the Iranian nation could be vanquished with the help of a few Iranian sellouts and a small number of aircrafts and helicopters, today they feel they need a coalition of tens of hostile or daunted states to counter Iran on the political and security fronts. And yet, they fail. Thanks to the revolution, Iran today stands out at an elevated position, one that the Iranian nation deserves to enjoy in front of the world. And Iran has already passed the challenging twists on the path of resolving its fundamental issues.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh,
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.